Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. A UN soldier posted in Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone, had this optimistic assessment just a few days ago. He said, "Africa needs a success story. Sierra Leone has the parts to be that success story." He was talking about the diamonds and the arable land and the current state of peace that's holding there today. Well, Daniel Bergner might be one who would challenge that sense of optimism. Daniel spent a number of months traveling in Sierra Leone after the worst of the fighting was past. And his story of that land is told in the rich character sketches of his book called In the Land of Magic Soldiers. The characters in Daniel's pages lead him to ponder some of the most basic and heart-wrenching questions about racism in Africa. Why is it that whites still hold such positions of privilege? And do black Africans living in Sierra Leone have the ability to heal their own country? We'd like to have you join us in this conversation. Do you see the ongoing failure of African states as a failure of black leaders or a holdover from decades of colonization or slavery? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Bergner is a writer based in New York City. As I mentioned, his new book is called In the Land of Magic Soldiers, and Daniel's in the studio with me here in Boston. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me on.
You did an interesting thing here. You didn't go charging in with all the other reporters when the Bang Bang was at its very worst to try and record that, but you chose to spend a lot of time in the country in the months after that. Why did you make that decision? What drew you there?
Well, two things. On the sort of intellectual, political side, this country was utterly lost, had gone through a civil war, the signature atrocity in which was that soldiers were cutting off the hands of civilians, then letting them live as a kind of ultimate emblem of terror. And meanwhile, there was a Western rescue effort just getting underway. And I wanted to see if that effort, that attempt at nation building could work. But much more emotionally, artistically, I wanted to follow the stories of a set of people, Western and African, black and white, who I met on my first trip there and who I thought could form the backbone of a very compelling story and who were pulling me into a place that was utterly foreign, exotic, entrancing, and that I didn't want to leave.
This idea of pulling you into a place sets up our first character in a sort of dramatic way, Lamine Diouf-Soudjarka. When you introduce us to him, and I'm going to just read the beginning of that paragraph. Lamine Diouf-Soudjarka took my arm in his metal claw. He forced me down, doubled me over, pinned my forearm to the long exposed root of the mango tree. Now, you go on to explain a little later in the chapter why he does that and that he is one of these double amputees. Maybe you can just read that part for us, Daniel, and then we'll talk a little bit more about Lamine.
Okay, well, this is a few moments after Lamine has actually saved his daughter from being raped, his 14-year-old daughter. A soldier has come to Lamine's house trying to claim her. Lamine's helped her get away, had to return to deal with that soldier, gotten free of that soldier, but finally been captured himself and herded into line. The mango tree's roots stretch 10 or 15 feet from the trunk, sprawling above ground at knee height. In line, Lamine sputtered the name of his tribe from the upcountry region where the rebels had originated, hoping to win sympathy. He tried to tell them in his tribal language and in Creole, the patois of the nation. "Brothers," he wailed, the line moving forward. But tribe, in this war, wasn't much of a factor. Half blind, tears streaming, beyond all self-control, he kept on. "Leave me so I can go with you. I am part of you. I beg you. I am one of you. I am with you. If you could just say for me to join you." A soldier seized his arm, forced him down, doubled him over, braced his forearm across the root. The young man straddling the root at the base of the tree wore sneakers, camouflage pants, a white t-shirt markered with his rank and title, C.O. Cut Hands. Lamine was sobbing, too tearful and afraid to get much glimpse of his face, and he still hoped that if he was respectful, didn't lift his eyes, C.O. Cut Hands wouldn't raise his axe. "I am with you, I am with you." The blade crashed through bone a few inches above Lamine's wrist. Against the root, his left arm replaced his right. A white burlap sack lay on the ground. Lamine's hands were tossed in.
You write about covering this story, Daniel, as something that you felt privileged to cover. And I got the distinct feeling in hearing you and in reading your description of Lamine's life and dignity that he's an example of what gives you that feeling.
He is. And I know it sounds strange to say that I felt lucky to be there to get close to and experience this horrific, to walk as I did over and over through that day with Lamine, to have him grab my arm and put it down to that mango tree and say, see, this is what happened. But if you think forward through Lamine's story, I think it's easier to understand. He's a man of incredible will, managed to get himself with a very few others to the United States to get prosthetics for his arm, and alone among those who managed to come, stuck with it long enough to teach himself to use these very basic devices. They are operated by a kind of strap that goes across the shoulders and then opens and closes these two steel pincers of each hand. And I remember one day we were walking through Freetown and we had bought a juice, and the change came, a coin between the size of a penny and a dime on a glass counter, and I began to reach for it, thinking that Lamine couldn't possibly pick it up, but he plucked it off that counter with those steel pincers, and there, as grim and bleak and sad as his story was also a kind of miracle of human will.
Does he stand out in Sierra Leone? Are there so many people with that type of injury that people wouldn't necessarily give him a second look on the street?
He is one of an inestimable number. Some say tens of thousands, some say only 1,000 or so who've actually lived after having this happen, because of course it's a country utterly without medical care, where most of the people who had their limbs cut off, their hands cut off, would have died shortly after. It is a country that's been traumatized by this atrocity, a country that lives in a kind of perpetual fear, and that's what explains the level of desperation and some of the things that I assume we'll talk about in a minute, where the desperation's so severe that Sierra Leoneans actually wanted to be recolonized by their British rulers because they were so traumatized.
Yeah, I do want to actually talk about that. But I thought before we go there, I'd get you to introduce us to one other character, because I don't want to leave our listeners with the impression that you were sort of walking around with the Murraytown amputees. Michael Josiah, did I pronounce that right?
Right.
This is a guy who really caught your attention.
Completely. Okay. Part of my attraction to Sierra Leone was a wish to bridge the distance between here, where we're sitting, and there. And that distance is almost unimaginable. Not only is it characterized by the war, but characterized by beliefs in magic that pervade the society, and made me feel often that the place was utterly lost, part of a separate planet almost. But Michael was a kind of bridge. Here was a guy who had managed to get himself into medical school, what passed in Sierra Leone for medical school, managed to get a very westernized type of education, and who, if you or I went to him in the lab, depleted though it is, of the Sierra Leone National Hospital, he could diagnose whatever disease we might come to him with. Yet, at the same time, he would go back and forth between his medical studies and fighting the war. And when he fought the war, he'd fight under the leadership of a spiritual figure, his malicious spiritual leader. And he thoroughly believed, knew, that his spiritual leader could immunize him against bullets, that his spiritual leader could make himself invisible in battle, that his spiritual leader could cure AIDS. And I wanted to know, and Michael was extremely articulate, and so I felt could give me a window into how he could hold these two utterly disparate worldviews.
He had this magic belt that he wore in battle.
He has a magic belt, and what often I would go to the lab with him. He would kind of take me to school. I was never much of a biology student, and so he would spend lots of time showing me the microbes under these two basically sixth grade level microscopes in the lab. That was all the lab was equipped with. But other times he would explain to me how he could believe and how I should believe in these other powers. And so if I can, I would just read quickly from his voice, trying to explain that to me. And I should say that as he was indoctrinated into his militia's hunting society, that was when he got granted the power, the immunity to bullets. "I was doubting, like yourself, at first," he said. "When I was initiated, I was not willing to line up with the others and put myself in front of the gun. But somebody shot at me while I was not aware, and from that point onward, I became more convinced. I have already told you about the bullet that struck my shoulder, but damaged only my jeans jacket. I have told you about the belt that pulled tightly around my waist whenever an ambush was nearby. Now think of the great father of modern science, Albert Einstein. When he first proposed his theories, of course, some people believed he was an imbecile. But his ideas would conquer. His ideas would bring an empire to its knees. You will see the same things here with disease. Daniel, when I am ready, I will call you. From the other side of the world, you will come and be my witness." His voice lowered in the darkened lab. "The absolute cure for all cancers, for leukemia, for all the most dreadful tumors, for the most dreadful contagion, and by that I mean HIV, will come from here. That is my dream. Through my work with the priests, my tests in the laboratory, I will publicize what these great men can accomplish with their powers. It will take time and dedication, but I will tell you for free, Sierra Leone will be a paradise. People will come from all over. The rich will come, the poor will come, the middle class will come. The hotels will be full. The hospitals will thrive. There will be such an economic boost, such a big economic boost, a boost you cannot imagine. And you will see me. I will be a rich man. Sierra Leone is a small country. Some do not know where Sierra Leone lies, but soon they will try to find where. Desperately they will try. You know that when someone is in pain, the most severe pain, he will pay anything in order to be cured, anything you ask him for. Daniel, it will be paradise."
Did you believe him?
I wanted desperately to believe him, as you can imagine, because after spending days with Lamine, days of having my arm held to that mango tree and days living Lamine's reality, of course I wanted to live Michael's reality of hope, and that's why his voice was so compelling to me. And I think I want it so badly that I sit here even now and can't answer you directly, can't quite say no, even though, of course, my rational mind tells me that it's impossible.
Daniel Bergner is my guest. We're talking about his book, In the Land of Magic Soldiers, A Story of Black and White in West Africa. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation about the remarkable clash of cultures that exists in a place like that. And we'll also be talking more when we come back after the break about questions of race, which were raised for Daniel and raised by Daniel in this book. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. The last time Daniel Bergner was here on the program, he was talking about a book called God of the Rodeo, The Quest for Redemption in Louisiana's Angola Prison. He's here today talking about his new book, In the Land of Magic Soldiers, A Story of White and Black in West Africa, detailing characters that he met in Sierra Leone. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And just before we completely step away from that sort of fascinating two spirit worlds that someone like Michael inhabits. You were given these demonstrations, Daniel. You saw people who were supposedly immunized being shot, plucking a bullet out of the fold of the clothing. Were you saying, nah, it's a gimmick, it's a gimmick?
Certainly the first time I had one of those demonstrations put on for me, I was saying it's a gimmick. I think the more and more I became immersed in the country, the more and more I became immersed in both its sadness and its resilience, the more I wanted to believe. So by the end, when Michael took me to meet his spiritual leader, mm-hmm. I very much wanted to see some evidence that his dreams could play out in reality. In the end, I think what amazed me more than the possibility that magic could really be taking place before me was the magic of the performance that was given out of so little, out of this sort of barren backyard that the spiritual leader had as his kind of sacred ground.
And just your own understanding of the spiritual side of life in Sierra Leone. I mean, for people who find their spiritual world in the church or the temple or the mosque, it's very different in that country. It never leaves these people.
It's a tremendous difference in degree, and I think it's all too easy to say, well, aren't we all spiritual people, and doesn't this kind of element of magic exist everywhere? In a sense, yes, but in a sense, no. There's a great difference. The spirit world in Sierra Leone inhabits the earth in a day-to-day way so that it is working constantly on everything. It is causing disease. It is making people fall dead of what we would call heart attack, but what they would call a bullet from a, quote, witch gun. So it permeates everything and changes the consciousness, changes the way people see their world, and changes the power or lack of power they see for themselves in affecting their world.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Medford, Massachusetts, and Rashid's joining us. Hi, Rashid.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I grew up in Sierra Leone in the 70s, and it truly was a paradise, as your guest is stating. And he also refers to the mango tree, which I really strikes some memories in my mind.
I bet.
Because in primary school, as they call junior school over there, I used to have lunch on a mango tree with my brother and some friends. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is it's unfortunate that Sierra Leone was allowed to go to such a low level where it is now. And I think the diamond trade has something to do with it. And so many lives have been lost in Sierra Leone, and I was wondering if the West could have done something about it in terms of economic aid and everything, or pay attention to it, like the West pays attention to places like the Middle East and Iraq. You know, Rwanda in Africa was ignored, and we paid attention to Bosnia, but we paid attention to Iraq, where there's oil. But we didn't pay attention to Sierra Leone. And I think the West should pay a price now in the form of reparations. And maybe instead of $87 billion to Iraq, maybe we should be able to give something like $10 billion to Sierra Leone to rebuild it.
Let's talk a little bit. Rashid, don't go anywhere. I want you to stay with me for a minute here. But
sure.
Let's talk a little bit about how the people in that country see the West. Because, Daniel, you sort of previewed a large part of the book a couple of moments ago by saying that country was so beaten down by its civil war that when the UN soldiers and when the British in particular came back, there was, you heard people saying, thank God we're going to be colonized again. I mean, in effect, those words, right?
Yeah, and it was terribly, terribly troubling to hear, but I did hear that over and over again. And I think that might be almost hard to believe for someone who was there in the 70s. I bet it wasn't that way in the 70s, but now has reached a point where people have so much lost faith in themselves that the faith is placed completely in the outsider. And so I was standing in jungle clearings hearing British trainees, Sierra Leoneans, calling out, "Long live the British," in a scene that could have been rising right out of 1880.
If I could make a comment about it, this is like the battered wife syndrome. I mean, Sierra Leone has been in such a poor state for such a long time, it almost wants to be not enslaved again, but sort of taken over by the British again. I think that after the British left, it was almost ignored, and something needs to be done in order to pay attention to the people of Sierra Leone. I mean, they're truly suffering. I mean, talking about 20,000 people without limbs is a terrible nightmare. Imagine if that was happening in Europe or here in the United States.
Rashid, you talk about giving money to Sierra Leone or helping with the economic reconstruction of the country. But I'd be interested in what you can tell us about your ideas of the psychological reconstruction, because there are people, strong characters in Daniel's book, who are saying, we don't have the capacity to rule ourselves. It's clear from the Civil War that we need some kind of ruler. And I mean, it's not we need a white ruler, but it's just we need that kind of strong arm.
Correct. Absolutely. I agree with you. It's not just giving away money to the people there. The money will just be squandered, as a lot of money was in the past. When you talk about people to people, one pledge I can request American young women to make, for example, is not to request diamonds for engagements. I mean, a lot of people are dead because of diamonds. The second thing we could do is training, political training of Sierra Leoneans and establishing institutions that would enable the Sierra Leoneans to use the money properly and not just among a few hands. I think the people of Sierra Leone are the most beautiful people in the world. I'm sure you're going to have some guests, calls from Sierra Leoneans. I don't know. I just learned about your program now. But I think Sierra Leone should be brought back to the Comity of Nations as we're trying to bring Iraq. Sierra Leone needs to be rebuilt.
There is talk now, Daniel, of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission involving lawyers from Freetown. I began the program with the optimistic comment of the UN soldier saying, Africa sure needs a success story. But at least in the book, you're not really particularly hopeful of this country being able to pull itself up by its own bootstraps.
What I cling to are the characters who I wrote about and who give me hope. Even a character we haven't yet talked about, Komba, who was a young boy kidnapped by rebel soldiers, taught to do everything, and I mean down to cannibalizing his enemies, but who managed by the end of my time there to get himself just precariously into this training program for auto mechanics, and so has gone from sort of the unimaginable horror to being a kid again. And if your car broke down in a particular neighborhood of Freetown, you might well have him leaning over your hood. And so there is hope, certainly.
Okay, but the training that he's getting is
extremely slow. Slow doesn't even characterize it. It's almost in itself a form of slavery, this apprenticeship that he's under. And he himself would worry if war breaks out again, violence breaks out again. He himself doesn't know where he'll wind up. And there's a feeling in the country that it is so cut off from where it desperately wants to be, and that is closer to the West, closer to what we have, that it's almost hard to imagine reaching out to reclaim it, or its own people reaching out to grab on and pulling themselves closer.
One of the things that you do as a storyteller here is allow us to see this country through your own eyes and allow us to kind of wrestle with some of the issues and the ethics of what's going on there and what needs to be done through your own reflections. And there was a part of the book I'm going to ask you to read now where you're very blunt with us about that. This was a decision, obviously, that you thought a lot about, because you've got such strong characters. You don't need to insert yourself to tell the story, but it helps us understand it in a way.
This is about race, and I continue to feel surprised by how little direct discussion of race comes up in reporting about Africa, except in that the stories of the history of slavery and the history of colonialism come up as factors of responsibility, of blame for what Africa now is. But I found it impossible to avoid race in the present tense, in the present tense psychologies of the whites who are there, in the present tense psychologies overwhelmingly of the Africans. And so I felt I had to confront what that brought out in myself. I want to tell you the truth. And if I tell you that Michael's intelligence and will and Lamine's miraculous determination and Komba's wish for a different life filled me with a great sense of hope for Sierra Leone, then I am not dealing in the truth at all. During the year that followed the ceasefire, hope had only vaguely to do with what I felt. The agreement kept holding tenuously. The rebels clung to their half of the country, clung to the best diamond mines, and there were skirmishes between them and the hunting societies. There were villages burned, mass abductions, people shot or mutilated, children slaughtered. But the outbreaks were brief. They were nothing terrible by the standards the country had grown to adopt, nothing the ceasefire couldn't absorb. There was talk, though they would not relinquish their guns, of the rebels becoming a political party. There was talk of national elections. No, my despair didn't come from broken peace. But before I say anything more, I must state the obvious, though I have stated it already. I am white. It needs saying because what I perceived in Sierra Leone may have had so much to do with my color as to make whatever I tell you unreliable and irrelevant. In the end, I do not believe this. But I do wonder if it is true. I do wonder if another writer, a black writer especially, would have seen the nation in some completely different way, if the reality I saw was a screen, blocking my view of what was real behind it. For at some deep level I cannot know, to a degree I cannot measure, a degree I can only hope was slight, I was drawn to Sierra Leone precisely because its terror and self-destruction offered me a kind of primal self-affirmation, a seductive proof, no matter how insidiously false, of the superiority of my own race.
That's Daniel Bergner reading from his new book, In the Land of Magic Soldiers, A Story of White and Black in West Africa. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts now, and Trina is with us. Hi, Trina.
Yes. Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure how to articulate what I'm feeling. I can't help but feel a little, frustrated because I think that the imagery of Africa that is sort of being invoked by the book and by the story, I think is the images that are overly promoted by the media, by the government of Africa, and that there are already examples within Africa of people, African peoples, rebuilding, reclaiming themselves. And that I think that we're always left with these images of this outsider needing to come in and do something about Africa, this mess of Africa, this big black continent. And I don't know, I was wondering if you could talk about the images of Africa that are sort of overly promoted and just that, I guess.
I mean, I share a lot of Daniel's perspectives from having worked as a reporter in different parts of Africa. And when you're a reporter or a writer, Trina, it has less to do with doing something about Africa and more to do with making sense of countries like that. You wouldn't have us look only for the happy stories in a continent like that, would you?
No, not only for the happy stories, but stories where people, that there is a sense of, you were talking about the spirituality of Sierra Leone, mm-hmm. and you were making that sort of connection. I think that there are examples like that that don't have to be sort of romanticized in this sort of happy way, but in sort of a purposeful way, you know. I think that gives people a very different kind of idea or perception of Africa than I think a lot of people come away with. I think that's all I'm saying.
Well, first of all, I should say that I was torn apart by the things you're talking about, by my own wrestling with how much of what I was seeing to put in. I felt, should I pull back? And in the end, I felt I had to be honest. But I should also say that someone like Michael represents to me exactly what you're hoping for. I mean, if I can just briefly describe the lab he had to work in. two sixth-grade microscopes, a sort of broken, encrusted centrifuge, specimens from patients coming in wrapped in newspaper, and one pair of rubber gloves to protect him or me. Of course, I want it to be me, but finally had the good sense to let him put the gloves on as he would handle the specimens. And out of that, so out of really nothing, he was able to make himself extremely knowledgeable in a way I can't imagine doing myself. So to me, Michael represents that kind of Herculean will, incredible intelligence, and hope. It's just that what surrounds him and what pulls in other directions is also very, very fierce and powerful in that country and on that continent.
Yeah, and I do feel that. I'm wondering how these stories, how do they sort of make our way? How do they, what are some of the sort of normal, conventional ways that they make themselves known, you know, to sort of a greater audience besides just sort of white Western writers sort of going in and telling these stories?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting observation, I think, Trina, because one of the things Daniel points to, and we certainly hear about it a lot here at the program, is that a lot of these stories and the understanding of that part of the world doesn't get covered in the mainstream press. And so, Daniel, we do, to a certain extent, need to have it told to us in a novel or in a book if it's not getting it to us through the media, right?
Well, that's certainly my hope, is what I'm doing here is presenting a realistic portrait and realistic stories that pull us into a world that we just don't see and often don't care to pay attention to.
Okay, Trina, thanks a lot for your call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Bergner's my guest. We're talking about his new book, In the Land of Magic Soldiers, a story of white and black in West Africa. It's a story of characters in Sierra Leone, Daniel, met over a two-year period of traveling to that country. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Daniel Bergner's with me in the studio. He's a journalist based in New York City who writes for a number of magazines, including Harper's and New York Times Magazine. And he's author of a new book, In the Land of Magic Soldiers, a story of white and black in West Africa. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go straight back to the phones now to Koopa, who's joining us from Central Falls, Rhode Island. Hi, Koopa.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, thanks for calling.
All right. And what I was trying to say in reference to what we have been talking about, especially, like, I mean, Africa, if you look at the Africans, we are trying to take development and responsibility on success for the continent of Africa into our own hands. And I also mentioned about it being undermined in terms of the Western world, actually, when you look at it, do not want to see the African nations coming together as one, such as Pan-Africanism, for the fact that once we are divided, it will be hard for us to take the kind of development that we need into Africa. But once we are divided, it gives the Western world or the so-called developing world the upper hand to be able to exploit our mineral, I mean, from Africa. And because we do not have the Pan-Africanism in Africa in terms of Africa coming together as one nation.
You're saying, Koopa, that the exploitation of the colonial days is just continuing as a form of sort of economic colonization today?
That's correct.
And when you look at countries like Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Liberia, I think you're from Liberia?
Correct.
Countries like that where the people have either turned or been turned so savagely upon each other. What's the lesson?
If you look at the people being turned upon each other, it's because the people that are turning on each other are getting that advances and other things. So let's take for a typical example. I'm a leader in Liberia right now. and I'm trying to steer Liberia in the right direction, and we have an opposition that come out in the name of democracy or in the name of any other form, then you will have a foreign government that will come in and say, oh, you know what, Mr. Cooper, you the president, you have to adhere to this, and if you don't do this, you don't do that, we'll sanction, we'll this, we'll do that, and all of that kind of create the problem for Africa.
The politics, Daniel, of Western involvement in countries like this obviously changes from one to the other. Liberia, we heard a lot about over the summertime. Sierra Leone, we're talking about on the program today. Is there a right way and a wrong way here? Has anybody figured that out?
I don't think anyone's figured it out. But one of the things, to go back to what brought me to Sierra Leone, was the British determination to do something in Sierra Leone. And it stands in very stark and somewhat successful contrast to what the United States has not done in Liberia. The United States basically sent some ships to float offshore and floated them quickly away and has done very little tangibly. What the British decided to do as I first arrived in Sierra Leone was to go in and, as they put it, somewhat arrogantly, sort out, their words, their former colony. Now, that involved about 1,000 commandos. It involved civilian advisors. It involved literally taking over and running the nation's police force, taking over and trying to run the nation's finances, trying to create a new army. What was good about this? It actually did, in the end, take the country from a point where I couldn't convince my driver to go 30 miles outside the capital when I first started going there. His response was, you sign the paper, you take the car, I'm not having anything to do with it, to the point where 2 years later, elections were held, and I could travel anywhere I wanted freely with my driver behind the wheel. What's troubling about it, though, is that there was such an utter psychological reliance on the British by the Sierra Leoneans, so that, you know, when your callers ask about this outside intervention, or when they talk about the sort of self-devastation and images of violence of Africa, that is the reality. And so that even at the very end of my time there, when some peace had been established, when the country had pulled itself out of a degree of desperation, still I was hearing, we want the whites, and it was put that starkly and that troublingly, we want the whites here.
Let's take another call from Rhode Island. Eric's joining us now from Providence. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. My question to the author of this wonderful book, apparently, is that did you get the opportunity to speak to any of those who committed the atrocities, the amputations? Were you able to talk to any one of those and get their point of views or the reasons behind their activity?
Do you mean, Eric, the children who were sort of brought in and by the rebels and the ones who did the cutting off of hands? Or do you mean
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
The answer is certainly yes. And Komba, who I mentioned earlier, kidnapped young child soldier, killed, cut, burned alive, cannibalized, is someone who forms a central part of the book, but talked to many, many others as well. And I guess the obvious question that follows is why? And it's a dizzying question, and a question that, to be honest, I could struggle to answer here, but also have to be honest in admitting I can't finally answer. And I guess that's part of the despair at the heart of the story. Part of the heart of darkness at the heart of the story is my inability to say why.
I've gone through something similar. I went back to Liberia in 1997 and tried to reestablish a business that I owned over there, and I was fortunate to employ ex-combatants and to listen to their stories of how they had their parents killed and their brothers and sisters raped or amputated, limbs amputated, and they told me of the mere suffering that they saw, and the forcing of them to join, and from then on it just continued and continued till it became so ridiculous. Well, thank you.
You didn't get any closer to the answer yourself, Eric.
Well, no. No, it was a cycle of violence, just a total cycle of violence. You did it to me, I will do it to you. That type of thing.
You remind me of one child soldier story. He was forced to kill his parents, cut off the limbs of his siblings. And
at what age?
You know, I can't remember, but at a very young age.
Like say, 12, 13?
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people said, well, the rebels fed these young children drugs. His response was, no, it wasn't the drugs. Imagine doing that to your own family. You're in free fall. You're outside yourself, beyond yourself. There's nothing left to cling on to after that. And after that, you're capable of anything.
You also tell the story of a fellow by the name of Neil Lewis, who's probably the best example that I've ever read of a white mercenary working in Africa, fought for apartheid, originally a Rhodesian, flies a helicopter for the government, and takes some kind of pleasure in what he can do from the air.
Exactly. He, to me, is the ultimate example of why reporters ought to spend a lot more time focusing on Africa, because they're amazing characters on that continent that we pay so little attention to. But in any case, Neil Ellis, mercenary pilot, would, if he were on the air with you right now, say openly, war is the biggest and best game available to mankind. He took tremendous pleasure and thrill in what he did, which was fly a helicopter gunship, which would spew not only rockets, but about 80 bullets per second. He had, as a Rhodesian, fought avidly on behalf of apartheid, but, and here was the moral complexity that I found so compelling and made me want to stay with him, he was flying near suicidal missions on behalf of the fledgling democratic government of Sierra Leone and giving away fair chunks of his mercenary salary to impoverished Sierra Leoneans, including Michael Hosiah, the medical student we've talked about. He was actually putting Michael through medical school.
Doesn't make what he does any more palatable, though.
It doesn't. What he does is, on the one hand, repellent, and certainly given his history, extremely, extremely troubling. But on the other hand, many Sierra Leoneans would say, this man is a savior. This man is the only thing, before the British arrived, that kept the country from being overrun by the rebels, who are the main perpetrators of the hand amputations. So again, it's dizzying morally, but that's exactly what draws me. I think he holds sort of good and evil in such a dramatic way, and in a way perhaps that we really all hold it in less dramatic forms.
Let's go to East Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Now Beth's joining us. Hi, Beth.
Ah, Paddy Coucher. I'm a former Peace Corps volunteer from Sierra Leone. I served 30 years ago, so my perspective is very dated. But I'd like to say thank you to Daniel Bergner, because so little has been written. I mean, one of your callers remarked on that. How do people know these things? And I look forward greatly to reading this book. My experience was with a greatly kind and generous people who had literally nothing, who would give me food, even though I didn't need it, because it was their custom to do. But I did notice quite a lot of that, the issue that that Daniel referred to about was his story the true story, because he was a white man coming to a black country. And I have to say that way back 30 years ago, I got very special treatment when my compatriots in the Peace Corps who were black were treated like other Sierra Leoneans.
And that meant treated badly?
No, but not with great fanfare and special. They didn't get the special treatment, you know, the VIP treatment. That perspective was very, very clear, and it was not something we tried to encourage, but it existed. And I do have to say to your caller who was earlier, I've been married 30 years, and I do not have a diamond. Partly because of my experiences in Sierra Leone, knowing what I've learned about South Africa. There are people like that out there, and I wanted to let them know that.
Fair enough on the diamonds. And, you know, maybe your callers or listeners would like just a quick picture of what those diamond mines are like. They are brutal places where people are kind of working stripped to their underwear, digging in mud pits for glittering stones that, for the diggers, will only win them at best a dollar or so. But on the larger subject of special treatment for white people, I agree. It's an issue. It's an issue for a white journalist. Of course, I would try to get around it by arguing back. I mean, as people, and I remember one bartender literally touching his skin and saying, "It's this, my black skin, or the black skin of my people, that's the cause of all the devastation you're seeing." You know, my response was constantly, "No, look at what white people have done over history." So there was sort of ongoing conversation through my time in Sierra Leone, each party taking sort of the opposite position that one might expect. I don't know that that led me to transcend the problem, but I tried to get as close to understanding as I possibly could just by listening very, very hard.
Last question, Daniel. You make the observation that when the British were there and training the people, you would see rebels and Civil Defense Force people wearing the uniform or whatever passed for a uniform of the new Sierra Leonean army. Was that for you a symbol of healing or not?
It was a symbol both of healing and of some foreboding. And I think maybe best to just quote the British trainers who were there, who were amazed at this ability of reconciliation. Some of the British trainers had been in Bosnia and said, you know, there's a lot more hope, a lot more possibility for people coming together here than there was in the Balkans. On the other hand, there's the foreboding sense, just locked into the randomness of the violence, the inexplicability of the violence, that makes one wary. How long will this peace last? How far are we from the chaos that took Lamine's hands away and that brutalized so many others during the war?
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Daniel Bergner is the author of In the Land of Magic Soldiers, A Story of White and Black in West Africa. Our website is www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.